to another episode, and joining me as always is...
Nick Newman. Hello, Ethan. How are you today?
And also, special guest...
Neil Bahadur, that's me.
Thank you for joining us, Neil. So, we're here tonight, all three of us. I mean, here in this specter of the internet to talk about Hour 10... of Twin Peaks Return, titled or episode descriptor. We still haven't sorted that out yet, but simply, Laura is the one. Neil, what have you thought of the return so far?
I think it's outstanding, in my opinion. It's hard to necessarily parse. I mean, now that we're halfway, I guess we can start to see. It's tough to say, given it's not made its full run. I don't want to make, a definitive statement or anything yet. But, now that we're kind of at the halfway point, the show's already been quite abstract in how it's kind of, interconnects its narrative. It's very, very, actually fascinating, striking. Sometimes it does get a bit slow for me, I have to admit, but that's kind of the nature of the organism dealing with AS. But outside of, there's actually one movie I've seen that I think is better than this, but I have a favorite of the year already, it's not, this is clearly the kind of most important, cinematic work of art this year, easily.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. what's that one better movie?
I don't know. I can say it's something I got a screener for. It hasn't premiered yet. I don't think I should have it.
is it your own movie, Neil?
No, it's not. My movie's not nearly as good as either of them. Believe me.
We should maybe brief shout out to Neil's film From 9 to 9, which actually, correct me if I'm wrong here, made its big screen debut in New York this past weekend.
Yeah, it was in New York, and actually it'll be online for free tomorrow.
Whoa, that's new to me.
Oh, yeah, excellent. Yeah,
the timing is great.
I don't have to awkwardly ask you for a screener. That's excellent.
It was a little of the plan. I just never mentioned it. More surprising. This is the big announcement, I guess. No, I guess casual.
Well, if we want to get the ball rolling here, I think... being more than halfway through the show now, the thing I've noticed is I feel like I can almost sort of group episodes together, where I feel like there's the episodes that are more steeped in kind of outright surrealism that I almost think of oddly as crowd pleasers, like hours 2, 3, and 8. Then there's episodes that are sort of a little more expository and are good episodes, but just kind of stay at one tempo and have no bad scenes, please everyone, like hours 7 and 9. But I think this episode we'll be talking about, I think, is kind of bunched in, I think, with hour 6, which I thought of as two episodes that I find almost a little more risk-taking in that.
They're six a little... Oh, sorry.
No, you go.
No, continue.
I think they're episodes that are less steeped in surrealism and more very upsetting and material, as well as extremely wild tonal shifts. And they're not the episodes that I think they're the episodes that please people the least, but I think maybe at the end of the day, by the time the show is over, they'll be possibly the ones that define it the most.
Right, yeah, no, I think I totally agree with you on that. Especially 6 in particular, that was kind of where, that's where I kind of really became impressed with what Lynch was doing just as just in terms of what he was doing to the structure. Or at least how I started kind of see what he was doing and not working through, say, basic juxtaposition in terms of how he's getting to a certain abstraction, but literally by the intermingling of these already established narratives and this juxtaposition of full narratives as opposed to sequences or shots. It's really brilliant. And then where it goes with episode 9 too, because now I think I think it was also starting to incorporate, there's something also a bit more meditative about this episode that I found, you know, compared to the rest. Although, I mean, although there's, you know, obviously a few things, which aren't, these aren't problems, but, you know, they're kind of key character moments with that, that guy who I guess is what, I guess he's Audrey Horne. Is that Audrey Horne's son now? That guy, the spooky dude? Like,
I can assume.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that was shocking on like a narrative. I mean, surprising on a narrative, but like it's kind of exciting to see where that will go. I guess, and obviously the kind of is Diane in with evil Coop stuff. That's kind of cool. Yeah, but there was some lovely stuff too. Little Grace notes too, like Diane and Dave and Gordon looking, just watching Albert at the table with a woman. It was kind of beautiful in that way.
Yeah, I am tentatively, as of this recording, less than 24 hours after it aired, thinking that this is actually my favorite episode we've seen from this revival thus far. And it's funny because it doesn't necessarily have an entirely clear standout sequence the way episode 8 did. It doesn't necessarily have as many surprises as the first few hours did. It doesn't even necessarily have a particular image that's as immediately captivating as, say, Amanda Seyfried in the car after having done cocaine in, I believe that was part 5. Mm-hmm. And yet there was just such a, I like what Neil said about sort of the flow of this and how this is one where there are kind of these longer sequences and the way that they are being stitched together and the rhythm between them, the rhythm between kind of absurdity and this unrelenting, very real-world horror, and kind of between a very almost ornate visual approach, visual style, and this very rough-shod kind of thing that almost, I don't know, looks it almost looks like something from Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer or something, the way that it's able to oscillate between those various forms, but also have them kind of be in conversation with each other, I was hugely impressed by. I mean, I watched this with a group of people, and we were all laughing hysterically, of course, at the Dougie, Janie-y sequences, because they are just about the funniest in the entire revival thus far. And then we were all basically hushed into silence. The scene involving Richard Horne, his grandmother, and I guess his uncle, let's say. And it was, yeah, I mean, it was kind of a roller coaster ride in a way that I don't necessarily anticipate from Twin Peaks. And so part of me is a little surprised that I'm saying this about it, that it might be my favorite episode thus far. But I think it was, yeah, I don't know, something about this hour in particular is everything working in a really beautiful harmony. And it has some shocks that I still am not over. For the love of God, Gordon Cole opens a door and he sees a superimposition of Laura Palmer in Firewalk With Me in distress, and then it sort of fades away and it's not really brought up again. And, you know, what in the world's going on there? I mean, it's the way it's able to, I mean, I suppose to use a popular piece of Twin Peaks terminology, it's the way it's able to kind of exist between two worlds that I found so immediately captivating. So yeah, I love this episode.
I just want to say I officially take back calling Dougie a cuck.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I was watching this with a group of people and someone who we all know, Eric Barroso, when Naomi Watts was just staring at Dougie, he just kind of sitting next to me, he just whispered, "Ah, she thirsty." Which, yeah, no, and she was. It's Dougie, Alpha Coop is still Alpha Coop, of course, but perhaps Dougie is now something of an alpha as well. I don't know. I don't know how you guys throw those terms together.
I think possibly that whole strand of this episode was, of course, a tribute, Frost and Lynch's tribute to the Family Guy episode where Peter gets plastic surgery and Lois wants to bang him again.
I didn't see that. I never saw that.
Well, you got plenty of time to. There's always after that we record this, Neil.
Honestly, I think like I thought that. I mean, as funny as the sex scene was, I actually thought it was like kind of. It was kind of like it's funny how like Dougie's arms kind of move up and down, like, on the bed. Like, but also just, like, the actual context of the scene is just kind of beautiful, too. So, and I love everything about Dougie and Janie's relationship now. It's really moving to me. I remember there's this shot in episode 8 when Dougie and Janie, you're waiting in the police station. And it's a really long push-in on Kyle MacLachlan, but Naomi Watts is on the shot. But Naomi Watts, there's, like, full range of emotions her face goes through that single shot. And, like, just, or whether that uncertainty, because they're so innocent compared to everything else. They're just these little two innocent, like, people in, like, this multi-dimensional, you know, whatever it is. It's really moving. And you know, and just to see that shot of her face this is someone who, like, cares about Dougie so much, you know, it's like, really touching.
I mean,
that's great.
I kind of wish we had a female guest on tonight. I'll mention we tried. If you're listening to the show and you think we don't have a female guest, like, we're aware of it. Okay. It just didn't work out this week. But
listeners, forgive us, please.
Yeah, but I kind of wanted there to be a female guest to, like, say, oh, come McLaughlin's abs.
Oh, that's good. That's true. He's pretty in shape, actually.
Props to the man.
That's nice. Man.
It is nice. I agree.
I mean, we've been talking about this episode having the kind of the juxtapositions. I mean, is this the only episode where we kind of see lower, middle, and upper class? Because essentially we have... Yeah, because we have the lower class, which is, of course, Becky and Steven in their trailer park fight. The middle class, Janie E. and Dougie, and the upper class being the Horn family.
No, yeah, it's pretty, like, it's interesting because, and there's, like, you know, how there's the casino bosses and stuff, too. It's interesting. Also, just, like, every time we have, like, some kind of link to Bad Coop, or even the shot of Laurie we see, because we're seeing these materialist, very materialist ideas of a class. At the same time, suddenly, we're being jolted out of that materialist mind space into, it's fascinating, these, like, things, you know, dimensional ideas. I mean, it's great.
It is great,
Neil. I mean, I'm still actually trying to parse 9 a lot, but I still honestly, like, the Dougie and Janie E in this episode, it really moved me. They're just so, and actually, Naomi Watts' sequence, but just in the news, on the TV, the newscast, she's, like, amazing in that sequence. It's incredible.
I agree.
Yeah, can I jump in about that sequence?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I am greatly amused by the thought of David Lynch in some post-production studio going over and approving or disapproving various animatics of dice rolling down and revealing the title local news. Just the little touch, the little bit of work that went into that and kind of the weird little world it creates or the embellishment it adds to the Twin Peaks world I really loved. But also something about seeing it from a different perspective I thought was really fascinating. Because when we had that moment in, I believe it was episode 6, when you see sort of like the first person view of this newscast, and it's kind of this very immediate, almost discombobulating thing, to actually see it on the news broadcast as somebody else is watching it, and to see kind of Dougie Jones / Cooper from a more distanced perspective, I thought was really interesting. I kind of like having that and getting some idea of how people in the outside world might see him. And it sort of raises, again, this question of why in the world aren't more people asking what is wrong with you? Because you have him standing there, blank face, and he's reaching out to touch the badge. And his wife goes, no, Dougie, don't touch that. He just kind of pulls back. And we're told, this is the second time we've seen this, so obviously Lynch and Frost like the slime, we're told that he moved like a cobra when he was disarming Ike the Spike. And yeah, I thought that was a neat little touch. I like how it sort of looped back in that way. I wasn't expecting us to return to that or for it to play a major part in the plot. Because initially it seemed like this stylistic flourish that Lynch was throwing in and experimenting with. Because it's unlike anything he's really done before.
Right.
But the way it's actually been integrated into the fabric of this large narrative, I really admired. Mm-hmm. So that's just a small thing.
Oh yeah, no, it's really nice. I agree. It's very unusual given like the structure of the show already. But it's interesting because it's kind of unexpected, but it's also kind of what's driving the plot now in terms of at least one of these stories was Dougie, right? You know, it's exciting. You know, it's great.
Well, I wanted to bring up to start another strand here. I find this sort of this additional comedy in the idea of Dougie being so, to quote Steven Seagal, hard to kill, where we now have apparently Tom Sizemore being carried into the Mulholland Drive eyebrows guy narrative with being tasked essentially killing Dougie. And I find Sizemore, because Tom Sizemore is an actor I'm a big fan of, but you know, you think of him, at least I guess from my perspective, films I sort of saw a decade after their release or around that, like Heat or Natural Born Killers or whatnot, where when he was kind of in his prime, and now he's kind of this guy with this baggage to him, you could say, of stuff maybe we don't need to get into. But there's something about even just the way Tom Sizemore walks that I find so intriguing, and one of the most kind of unheralded aspects of this show in terms of representing the passage of time and aging, and specifically how I almost find Sizemore being now in this predicament of having to kill Dougie. Somehow, like, I imagine that being like Sizemore being in his predicament of having to do, as per IMDb, around 15 film credits per year to likely pay for all his legal bills, which he'll never be able to catch up to.
Jesus Christ. You've really thought about this. This is something that really crossed your mind. Okay.
You watched the episode twice.
It's funny, because I actually didn't fully realize that was Tom Sizemore until you mentioned it, because I totally recognized him. I was like, who the fuck is that? Is that, like, at first I was like, this is really stupid. I was like, at first I almost thought it was Ray Winstone, you know, from The Departed.
Yeah.
But then I was like, okay, no, that is Tom Sizemore. But that's true. The baggage, it comes, he's very recognizable, that's the thing, you know. And he's coming, and it kind of does play into all these characters, you know, a lot of these characters older, because Tom Sizemore also in a lot of ways is this character actor that has kind of subtly integrated himself into a kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say greater or more mass-produced context or anything, but he's just that figure is recognizable. I didn't realize. Also, I was just noticing that the sequence where he goes to the casino and they're upstairs in the room, like the way those two dudes act is so funny. Like they're just like cartoons. Like they just make faces at the camera. It's so they're just like, I don't know, I can't know how to translate this through words. I'd have to like mimic the face. Well, but it's hilarious.
There's a screen cap comparison I think going on. I think if we've seen the meme of the dog making the frowny face, how that's exactly like McLaughlin when Janie E kind of propositions him, so to speak. There's also a face though that Belushi makes where he's watching the surveillance footage. And I don't have my Skype camera on, so I can't do it. But I'll say his frown also feels like a dog meme in and of itself.
I hear that. That's funny. Oh, man. It's funny, too. It's weird. Both, especially Belushi's face in particular. I keep forgetting the names of the actors in this show. I don't know why.
There's so many of them. That's why.
Too many. I mean, it's not too many. There's just a lot. You know, there's not enough, but it's great. It's wonderful. But it's also the way it's lit, that shot to the very, it's very, just one key light, and then shadows kind of take over the other half of the face. It's very much, so you kind of see these lines, especially in Belushi's face particularly, you see all these lines on his face highlighted. It's very silent, very like, I don't know, I wouldn't want to say, I feel if I said Sternberg, it would be a bit, maybe not. I might be being a bit superficial if I said Sternberg, but it did remind me of like certain shots and, you know, I'm thinking more in the line of like George Bancroft, the actor, how Sternberg likes George Bancroft, and he's constantly kind of pouting and like basically making this face so the light hits it and kind of covers a lot of these crevices. It's very, very unusual. But I don't know, do you think Lynch has any serious relationship towards silent film? You think he's, if I don't know much about his, like, what other influences he might have, obviously.
I mean, I think you've brought this on the show before. Generally, his relationship with cinephilia is, he's like, oh, Bergman, Fellini, you know, that. But I actually did find someone, I think, even posted this on Twitter, there on YouTube. It was him on the BBC right after Blue Velvet came out, like doing almost like a program of early experimental cinema, kind of like Man Ray, maybe even Maya Darren. I mean, that stuff, I imagine that he may have just been shown to him in art school. Maybe he didn't seek it out himself, but I think that's how far his relationship with silent cinema goes.
Yeah, because I mean, at the same time, also Lynch is also kind of, especially here, he's kind of mastered shot reverse shots in a way that's like I haven't really seen contemporary cinema, and not even really in silent cinema either. It's very detached, yet at the same time, so much shot reverse shot is meant for subjective identification to some degree, but Lynch is making it so it's very, very objective. There's no one to relate to, which is great. Well, maybe there's someone to relate to, but I guess that's more because of the amount of characters in it, but it's remarkable the amount of how often the technique's being used, yet it's not asking for too much emotionally, I think, you know? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, Nick, if we talk more about style, Nick brought it up earlier, kind of the Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer stuff.
Right.
The kind of Horn family robbery sequence, you want to speak, it's very interesting in that I think Lynch is good at this. It's seen in Fire Walk Me, of course, the horror in the daytime, kind of. And especially specifically that sequence, like you said, how flat the lighting is, and having this random Francis Bacon teddy bear introduced in the middle of it. And just, I think it's one of the few sequences in the show so far that really uses, I mean, it's not necessarily ostentatious in this, but handheld.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of harsher quality to it than I think.
Not just handheld, but also how the camera is kind of hovering in a way. And how it sort of is, it doesn't seem, there's this kind of nervous energy to it as well. And also how when Mrs. Horn is going to her son on the floor, the way it's kind of swooping down with them, and it's kind of at this canted angle, and it feels at once intimate, but also kind of, I don't want to say theatrical necessarily, but there's something about it that has a slight distance from reality. It doesn't necessarily play as cinema verite exactly. It has something a bit more, in a way, almost literally off kilter about it.
And
just for me, as I'd said this on Twitter, so I'm kind of regurgitating my point here, but one thing I said is how there are so many scenes, and really to that and entire narratives in the show that have such a beautiful visual design to them. They have such a warm lighting, and they have these very kind of hard-held, steady shots and these very fine cuts. And those often seem to involve people of great wealth, which I find really interesting, or the FBI, the people who are ostensibly these powerful figures. And how it seems as though when he's going into the more seedy aspects of this particular series, he's kind of going to a low style, we could say. I think we see this in the first scene of the episode when Richard Horn goes to visit the woman who saw him kill the kid. And it's at first it's actually quite calm because you have this shot reverse shot between them. And there's even a slight surreal touch to it because Richard Horn's reflection seems to be superimposed onto the screen door. Because even the way it appears, it doesn't seem natural that it would actually show up on the door this way. But the way he's kind of, the way he's almost like transmitting his presence onto this scene even further, I thought was really wonderful. And then when he charges in, we see inside this, you know, initially we have kind of this distance view of it. And I noticed something weird, which is that when there's kind of that thud, when it seems like he smacks her down, did you guys notice that the camera kind of shook a little bit? There's a slight tremor in the image that is very finely woven in. Sorry?
I totally noticed that too. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. No, I thought that was wonderful. I mean, wonderful as it, in as much as something of that kind can be wonderful. And then you go into the trailer itself, and it's just kind of this very dank, shaky camera approach. And then also, similarly, at the Fat Trot trailer park, you finally see Caleb Landry-Jones and Amanda Seyfried again. And it's such an intense close-up to a point where her face almost doesn't even look human, and neither does his exactly. I like how he's kind of transposing between these different styles, and he's jumping between them. And I don't know, I found the effect quite strong, because then we go to them in the hotel room, for instance, the FBI agent, and it has this just beautiful, warm, almost golden glow to it.
It's interesting. It's framed, especially the first shot of that sequence. It's framed almost like it's like very cubist in a way, but at the same time, it's rather kind of pretty. It's like, damn, this is a cool space.
Well, I think too, what I noticed is we saw the return in this episode of the surveillance room in the casino. And I think that's too becoming one of the most interesting locations of the show so far. Not just that it has the three showgirls kind of constantly hanging out in the back, but there's something where I don't even know if this is necessarily intentional, but it still makes the shot more interesting. How I think it's very clearly shot against a green screen, at least when there's the large surveillance screens behind Belushi and Knepper. And it gives, I don't know, it feels like one of the most intense places of confrontation throughout this show, dating back to the Belushi-Knepper introduction back in Hour 5.
No, I love the, like, I think those are definitely green screen too, but just on a visual level, it's really well, like, I don't want to use the term designed, because I don't know if that's the word I mean for, but it's just a striking image in its own self. I just wanted to mention something going back to the reflection thing with Richard Horne, which is, there's a few times with his character that I've noticed reflections play into some kind of tonal abstraction that he's done. I also noticed in episode 6, it's in between Richard killing the kid and him like doing that coin thing with the black, the other older dude. I can't remember which actor it is either.
Alvin Getty.
Yeah. And he's driving his car and he's kind of yelling and freaking out. And you see these the greenery from these trees rushing like past the image on the reflection of the windshield. And it's very, it allows for a very unusual that character. And it continues obviously after he hits the kid. And he's still yelling, get out of the way, or whatever, and so on. And so I've noticed Lynch do it a couple times. He also does it at the end of episode 4. When, I can't remember this character's name either. They're really, she's awesome, too. It's not Diane. Is a new character at the end.
Tammy?
Tamara?
Yeah. It's Cole and Albert, and they're talking about about something's very wrong here, and it's right before he says there's something very wrong here, and she turns and walks away, and they turn and look, and there's these weird like shapes that are reflecting off like this glass wall, and they're just looking at it, and this is right after I think some evil Coopian incident, I swear, but I don't know, it's interesting when he does try something abstract visually, because it comes in very subtly. It's very, very smart. It's really intelligent. It's just great. Oh man, I'm very curious to see what happens with Richard, because he's slowly becoming, I think, the most interesting character for me. Richard Horne.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about the actor's face that's so naturally snake-like that makes him compelling. I mean, we talked about this in episode 6, how he seemed to show at least a bit of remorse. And I mean, I think it's maybe even established at the beginning of this episode, the first character he kills in this episode is someone he may have even known personally by how he refers to her by first name. So I'm curious how much backstory we'll get, but I'm also curious, I mean, when are we going to get Audrey back, and how much is she going to be used? Is she going to be, hopefully, I mean, she's not just a device to develop him, like just to humanize him or whatnot, but obviously, that dynamic will be interesting.
I doubt that would happen with Audrey, but it's just true. I've been kind of, Where's Audrey? Except for the 10. But I mean, it's not a big deal. I'm still enjoying it. Like, it's where Lynch will take it. That's fine. It's his movie. You know, it's his cinema. Let him do what he wants. But yeah, I'm really, you know, more than seeing what happens to Evil Coop, but after that, it's where what happens with Richard is really most interesting me most, you know. And I think they do know each other, like, at the beginning, because, like, he does come straight, he sees her, and then he goes straight to where she lives. He must, like, have some kind of acquaintance with her, at least. I figure. No, you were about to say something. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, we have the return to, this is where something else I was thinking about. We have the return of the log lady. Who knows if this will be her last ever appearance, but I mean, I think everyone expected her brief scenes in the first 2 hours to be basically all there was going to be. And it made me think about how, guess that scene at the end of the episode could have been in the first 2 hours. I mean, if the Hawk scene was just a little longer. And I'm starting to wonder how much the show in editing is diverting from the script and deliberately playing with structure and really kind of putting a theme to specific episodes. I mean, we talked about, obviously, hour 8 is a standalone episode in and of itself, with maybe a few exceptions. But yeah. I'm sort of, because, I mean, I kind of posited this at the top of the episode, how there are certain episodes that just feel like they mirror each other. I mean, I was making the hour 6, hour 10 comparison. Another comparison, I think, between these two is that there's no bad Cooper in either, and how kind of it complicates the shows. In both these hours, it complicates, again, the show's conception of evil and unrest. So
yeah, no, that's a good point. And I mean, I think also it's not just the extreme evil we're seeing of Richard Horne, but also this kind of almost ambiguous evil with regards to the Mitchum brothers, because watching it, I can't quite figure out what their deal is, because they do beat the shit out of Brett Gelman, as the casino boss. But you look at the whole sequence where one of them gets swatted with a remote control by what's her name, Candy, the sort of the floor girl, and he's being kind of sweet to her, actually. I mean, there's it really upends expectations how she's just like hysterical, she's in fits. And his response is just, I like how initially his response is, sweetheart, it's fine. And then he just kind of gives up and just sort of turns on the TV. I thought that was, I don't know. I love that little dichotomy there. And just the question of what exactly these people have in mind. I mean, there's the whole thing about how they're supposed to kill Dougie Jones, but there's something about them where it's almost, I don't know, there's something bizarrely comic about them where they're almost like the Three Stooges at this point, with more real-world violence, let's say.
Like they do come off these like comically inept, they look like comically inept figures. That's how they're like, but I don't know if they are, but that's how they just look like. That's how these, you know?
It's part of what makes Belushi such a good casting, I think.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, something else I want to bring up is, again, this just a note to make about the episode's concluding Rebecca Del Rio performance, bringing her back, of course, from Mulholland Drive, though maybe it's actually his tribute to Southland Tales and her performance of the Star Spangled Banner in that. But it's a note I wanted to make is that apparently, I mean, this song, No Stars, actually, it goes way back because, I mean, Lynch is credited as a co-writer on it. Apparently, she sang it at the 2004 Twin Peaks Fest. So it feels almost like destiny that this song in that universe would finally mingle on screen.
Do you think there's anything more from that? Like any greater implication that could be made from that? Or is it just like a note that Lynch made, I guess.
Well, I mean, I think people are starting to, you know, when there's a week between episodes and people are going on Reddit and trying to take the lyrics of every song and deduce if it has a meaning on the episode. I mean, it could. I wouldn't tell, and I wouldn't say no necessarily, because who knows with this show really. But I do think it's interesting because it is, too, I think, the longest performance and also the shortest episode. It's like a full 6.5 minutes, basically. And it's, again, kind of, I almost see it as, you could say it's representational of how the show has no fucks to give about traditional television structure and pacing. But I feel like the gesture of it has some weight.
Right. How long was the 9 to 9? I'm sorry, 9 Inch Nails.
that was also, I think, around 5.5 minutes.
Do you guys think, like, when you guys watch, like, especially these last two episodes, would you contextualize, like, these last two episodes of what you saw in episode 8, or would you just kind of continue with the narratives as they unfold and kind of wait for it to return to the subjects from that episode?
That's a good question. I would say that there's, for me, the only thing from the two recent episodes that I think has directly, that feels as though it directly connects is somewhat appropriately the beginning of episode 9, because the first shot of episode 9 is Alpha Coop walking down this dirt path, looking kind of disheveled beyond disheveled, to the point where it almost seems as though his skin is rotting. And right, something about having gone through this really insane, intense experience, which may or may not be his origin story, essentially, and then going from that, with the girl lying on the bed and the bug is crawled in her mouth, this kind of very ominous, bizarre, creepy thing, and then kind of the harsh light of day from black and white to color, this harsh light of day of him just walking down the street. And there's something, I don't know, there's something kind of, how would I put it? He's clearly sort of moved on from his own origin in a way. Like, he's here in the now. He's here in the present moment, and the present moment really sucks. And he's just trying to get to where he has to get to and meet the people he has to meet. Something about that transition I found really powerful. Yeah, I mean, there are serious narrative implications to him getting shot, and we sort of pick up after all of the crazy, more explicitly avant-garde material. So, yeah, I mean, I do think of it, I think I think of it more of in a broad sense in that way, not necessarily in terms of connected pieces.
Again, I mean, my expectations of the show are, I have no idea what to expect every week now, so I almost expect next week to start in New Mexico in 1956. who knows, really?
I remember I tried to, like, watch, I tried to, the reason I didn't do episode 9 till this week, which I totally flowed easily into 10 for me, is because, like, I tried to rewatch episode 8 and go into 9, but then I just had a really hard time with it. Just getting back into it, I don't know, it's odd. So I just had to, like, strip it out of my mind for a bit and be like, okay, no, just let Lynch take you where he wants you to go, kind of. I was, like, trying to just, like, make all these comparisons in my head and just wasn't really working.
Well, I mean, I know when, likely, when I sit down and by the time, you know, the Blu-ray's out and I watch the entire thing in one day, inevitably, I think instead of watching it 18 hours continuously, I feel like I may split it into parts 1 through 8 and parts 9 through 18.
Right, yeah. 8 seems like kind of the perfect kind of cutoff point in a way.
I mean, we can bring up this week in Unlikely Twin Peaks fandom. Apparently, Herman Cain is a fan.
What? Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Did you see this? I should send this to you guys on Twitter. Apparently, go to Herman Cain's Twitter account.
I'm going there. I was already just on it. So he's got a picture of Bobby.
Yeah,
right, I'm gonna look.
And it says Al Gore fighting global warming is like abolishing slavery. And there's just a photo of
Here's a photo of Jacoby. Rand Paul, McConnell doesn't have the votes to pass healthcare bill again. Why is what? Oh wow, there's like there's three in a row.
They're so strange.
I think this Twitter account truly has that DMX feeling.
This is amazing.
Oh wow.
I think that's as much as maybe that's really the overarching mystery is which unlikely celebrities will be unearthed as fans through social media.
This is like super funny to me. It's so strange. Herman Cain loves new twins.
do we have any closing thoughts?
Honestly, I think that's a pretty perfect note to close on. Keep it real.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
You know what? I'm excited to see next week's episode. That's what I tell you.
And it has a very cool title. There is fire where you are going. So that sounds pretty spicy. And we should mention, actually, that episode will be screened at Comic-Con 2 days before airing. So maybe it is a very special one. Who knows?
Bring on episode 11, David. We love you.
I'm slamming my laptop right now in demand of the episode.
Clapping for David. Good man.
Okay. You're a good guy. Well, Neil, where can we find you on the internet?
I guess best place to find me is probably just my Twitter account.
Yeah?
At Nigel Bahadur.
It is a very good account. I recommend following it. And you have your, as you mentioned at the top of the show, your movie is dropping. Where else can we can find that? Where?
It'll drop through my good friend Kurt Walker has a website called Keynet, which he, uses to as a kind of mini sort of festival, online festival type thing. And it'll be dropping through that. I'll have a link to it on my Twitter as well.
Okay.
That should be by like noon tomorrow or something.
Yeah. And it's called?
From 9 to 9.
Ooh.
Good. Spooky.
Yeah. And Nick, of course, thank you as always for joining me, as you do every week. Where can we find you, as always, Nick?
There's thefilmstage.com, there's twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and there are my real world doings with Grasshopper Film.
Yay!
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening. My dream.